Despite mixed messages from the Trump administration, all signs point to the Russians being behind a major cyber attack on the U.S. government.
The amount of information and the targeting of both of companies shows a very, very sophisticated actor.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 22nd, we'll talk about how hackers were able to access government and business systems and why we're still so vulnerable to these attacks. Also on the show, after a spring and summer of uprisings against police violence, the New York City Police Department admits a string of incidents where they used excessive force.
There needs to be an acknowledgement that it's not a problem of a few bad apples. These are systemic problems, and we need to replant the whole orchard.
Plus, the playwright August Wilson comes to Netflix, and for many, it's an introduction to a classic. New York Times theater critic Maya Phillips talks with me about it. All right, let's do this. Earlier this month, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or the CISA, warned federal agencies that a wide-ranging cyber attack had infiltrated a number of government agencies, including the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy, the Treasury, and numerous private sector organizations. While the extent of the breach is still unknown, the CISA said the hack posed, quote, a grave risk to federal, state, and local governments and businesses across the country. What does seem to be known is who's responsible for the cyber attack.
This was a very significant effort, and I think it's the case that now we can say pretty clearly that it was the Russians that engaged in this activity.
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on the Mark Levin Show last Friday. And on Monday, Attorney General William Barr agreed with Pompeo's assessment of the situation during a press conference.
From the information I have, I agree with Secretary Pompeo's assessment. It certainly appears to be the Russians.
The only one, it seems, who does not believe the Russians were behind the hack is President Trump, who downplayed the severity of the hack on Twitter over the weekend. But what this hack means for our national security and how a Biden administration might handle future attacks is where we start today on The Takeaway. Chris Painter is with me now. He's the U.S.'s former top cyber diplomat at the State Department from 2011 to 2017. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here with you.
And Nicole Perlroth is a reporter at the New York Times covering cybersecurity and digital espionage. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Tanzina.
So, Nicole, how were hackers able to infiltrate federal systems?
So they came in through what's known as a supply chain hack in this case. We know there are multiple ways that they broke in, but so far the only way that's been confirmed is that they actually breached a Austin company that provides some back-end IT software to federal agencies, to 425 of the Fortune 500, to nuclear laboratories, apparently. And basically what they did was they compromised the software update that made its way into these systems. And so when these businesses or federal agencies updated their software, they did it with what was basically a Russian backdoor.
So, Nicole, is it confirmed that Russians are behind the attack? We heard Mike Pompeo say this, former Attorney General Bill Barr say this. Do you, as a reporter, have that confirmation as well?
I never want to say we have the confirmation until we've seen what they call TTPs, which are indicators of compromise, which are just techie speak for hardcore evidence that ties it back to this particular Russian hacking group. But everything I've heard suggests that right now the intelligence community believes it's the SVR, which is a successor agency to the KGB, and has popped up before, and Chris can probably speak to this, but they popped up in a pretty aggressive hack of the State Department and the White House back in 2014, 2015. They're really known as one of the most sophisticated Russian hacking units that we know of. And what makes them so sophisticated is they are very quiet. They are very targeted. They're very custom in their tooling. They use custom tools for much of what they do, which makes it really hard to anticipate when they're going to break in. And once they're in, they plant back doors. And one thing I remember from the 2014-2015 State Department hack is that they actually took control of the system that incident responders were using to investigate the hack. So they would come in and they would think that they had eradicated the Russians from their system. And what had really happened is this group had simply taken control of their tools and basically saw what they were detecting and used new implants that couldn't be detected.
Chris, let's turn to you. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency said that the government agencies targeted in this hack may have been compromised since March. And there's data that shows it goes as far back as October 2019. Why did it take us so long to discover this?
Well, as Nicole said, this is a very sophisticated actor, if it is indeed the Russian SVR. And that really everything points to that. And the SVR is sort of the equivalent of our CIA or NSA. They're an intelligence agency. They have very good tradecraft. You know, and it does look like it's gone back to the compromise back in October through this piece of software that people really weren't paying, I think, enough attention to.
And I'm going to stop you there, Chris, because why weren't people paying attention? Isn't that someone's job?
Well, it's a lot of people's job. But here's the problem. First of all, offense is always better, easier than defense. You have to protect all your assets, all your different systems. And a dedicated attacker, especially a sophisticated nation state, really needs to concentrate on one vulnerability. But even with that, I'd say that we haven't either prioritized or resourced cybersecurity, particularly the defense, but not just the defense, throughout our entire government and really our country, as a core issue of national security, of economic security, where it needs to be. And I think that's been a problem. And it's been under-resourced, too. We haven't put the money and resources or priority under this, and particularly during the Trump administration, as you know.
I was just going to ask you, is that a political decision, particularly from the Trump administration, given that so far President Trump himself has sort of downplayed this attack being from Russia, but his own former attorney general and secretary of state are saying this is from Russia? I mean, was this deliberately underfunded or not given the resources because the potential for Russia to have access to these systems?
Well, I think from the very beginning, Trump has not been strong on cybersecurity. He's always not really paid attention to this issue. It was a very big contrast from Obama, whose own campaign was hacked into, and he made it a priority, maybe not enough of a priority. And you certainly see that Biden, the Biden administration, is looking to do that too. But Trump never really cared about this. And when it came to Russia, just incredibly, anytime Russia did any what we call malign cyber activity, whether it be this activity or the big computer worm that was called NotPetya that caused a lot of destruction around the world, including with respect to the Maersk shipping lines, or the election interference, or even that attempted hack of the UN doping agency, Trump would never say anything at best. And at worst, he'd undercut everyone else in his administration by saying the Russians didn't do it. And what that does, if you don't have that consistent high level messaging condemning this activity, it just emboldens the adversary, it emboldens Putin to do this again and do it stronger and do it better. And so that's a real problem. That's part of the solution, is we need to be clear and strong that this is unacceptable.
Chris, we are talking here about a hack that could have and potentially has already affected the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy, the Treasury, numerous private sector organizations. What does it mean to have those organizations or those agencies be hacked? What information is now available?
Well, it's unclear. This is going to be an ongoing story for a number of weeks, if not months. As Nicole said, it's very hard to get these folks out of our systems once they're in. It's hard to do the forensics to figure out what they've taken. This does look at this point that it is an espionage campaign. And that's serious, to be sure. But we're lucky it's not a more destructive campaign. The question is always, is there pre-positioning, which means that you're there to do something more destructive in the long term. Right now, it looks like it's espionage. But even as espionage, there's an incredible wealth of information, even on our unclassified systems. At Treasury, for instance, dealing with sanctions, and certainly Russia is the subject of sanctions, financial information, Homeland Security, how we're defending our networks and how we're defending our physical infrastructure is there. There looks like an ever-expanding group of agencies that are targets of this and private sector companies. So this is a mother load of potential information. Now, how much has been gotten, how it's going to be used, unclear yet. But certainly this is a very sweeping and serious event.
Nicole, has President-elect Biden said anything about this so far?
He has. He has said more than the president has said. Last week, he said that he plans on imposing significant costs on anyone who would do this. And he's just been much quicker to respond to it overall.
Chris, we've reported here on the show about before the pandemic, there were a number of hacks on local government systems, on school systems across the country. Do we know whether or not local governments and smaller networks like school systems across the country have also been affected by this hack, or is this really focused on the bigger players?
My guess is, and again, this is still an evolving issue, is my guess is this is focused on high-value targets. So government agencies, big companies, unlikely more local targets. They're certainly the subject of intrusions and also disruptive attacks almost every day. So that shouldn't make us feel better necessarily. And just on the statement about what Biden has said, the other thing he said, which I think is critically important, is that he said in that statement that cybersecurity will be a priority at every level of my administration, which is a key thing because it goes back to what I was saying. If we don't treat this as a core priority and not some outlier technical issue, we're not going to make the progress we need to make.
Chris, Mike Pompeo surprisingly split with the president when he acknowledged that this could, in fact, most likely were Russians here. Given that split, what type of repercussions would you expect to see, if any, before President Trump leaves office?
Repercussions for who?
For Russians, the hackers, the people by you laugh because there probably won't be any. Is that right?
Yeah. Look, I was pleasantly surprised that Pompeo was that clear and forthright and that Barr joined him Monday after the president called out on this. But that's exactly right. I don't really expect any major cost being imposed on the Russians before the next administration. You know, again, this was espionage. But still, even if it's espionage, which everyone does, every country has done since the beginning of time, it doesn't mean we need to sit still and say, good on you. We can still take action.
Chris, just to be clear, before we end the segment, you're saying espionage versus what?
Well, a more destructive attack. So espionage is just the theft of information, but a computer attack that might, say, cripple infrastructure or go after the internet being up or go after financial systems. That's another class from this. That more destructive attack could be much more disruptive. But that, again, doesn't mean we can't react to espionage, especially as broad as it is and the way this is conducted that affected the supply chain that could have even broader consequences. So we don't sit on our hands. We can and should take action, particularly calling the Russians out, which unfortunately this president hasn't done.
We'll see if that changes in the next couple of weeks as a new administration takes office. Chris Painter is the U.S.'s former top cyber diplomat at the State Department, and Nicole Perlroth is a reporter at the New York Times covering cybersecurity and digital espionage. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Sure.
Thanks, Yanzina.
During this summer's racial justice uprisings, demonstrators and journalists in New York City frequently accused the New York Police Department of using unnecessary force to quell the protests. And now a new report from New York City's Department of Investigation substantiates many of those claims, saying that, in fact, the NYPD did use excessive force and did not have a clear strategy to respond to the mass demonstrations. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio apologized for his handling of the police during the uprising.
I'm reflecting on what happened in May and June, and I look back with remorse. I wish I had done better. I want everyone to understand that. And I'm sorry I didn't do better, and I've learned a lot of valuable lessons, and I want our police department to do better.
But a number of civil rights advocates are saying that, quote, doing better will require much more than just following the recommendations outlined in the new report. Joining me now to talk about this is Phil Stinson, a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, a former police officer and author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence. Phil, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's good to be with you.
And Jake Offenhartz is a reporter at Gothamist who reported on the uprisings for racial justice in New York City this summer. Jake, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Jake. Some of the errors that the New York City Police Department committed that were at least highlighted in this report, talk about deploying officers without proper training. Jake, I've heard this response before from police departments. How is that acceptable?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily acceptable. I think that this report really sort of zeroed in on a lot of the structural problems within the department. They found that even going back to the police academy, there's not a ton of focus on training for protests. And very often this falls under training for just disorder. So there's these disorder control tactics that were used. That's one of the recommendations. They say that that police officers need to be trained to handle protesters better. I would also say that I've spoken to civil rights attorneys who say the NYPD knows exactly what they're doing in terms of policing protests, and this is not their first rodeo at all.
Phil, I have to ask your thoughts here because you have been a police officer, and just hearing the NYPD here in New York City say that some of these officers just didn't have the proper training or were just too inexperienced, again, feels like an excuse here. I mean, how is it that police officers aren't trained to handle protests?
Well, I think they are trained to handle protests. One of the problems that we see here, though, and we see this not only in New York, but in other agencies across the country, in a few places in specific, where the law enforcement executives, the police chiefs, the county sheriffs, the rank and file deputy sheriffs and police officers simply didn't understand that this was a protest about the police and in some cases really against the police. And they really didn't acknowledge that. And it wasn't really a lack of training. It really, in my view, was a lack of empathy, that police officers on the street really weren't engaging with the protesters and letting them know that they acknowledge what the problem was here and letting them express their First Amendment rights. So I agree with Jake. I really think that it's not the first rodeo for the NYPD. They certainly have all sorts of training in this area. And it's not a matter of a lack of training. It's a lack of empathy.
Jake, you were on the ground actually covering these protests over the summer, so you saw with your own eyes the interaction between police officers and protesters. How would you describe it? And again, with the understanding that we're talking about larger trends here, not always individuals, but was there a sense of hostility between the protest and the police often? Were you feeling that sort of tension?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think hostility, seething anger, whatever you want to use. This was really a moment that I think a lot of us had not seen before, just in terms of the level of sheer rage. And a lot of that was directed towards the police department. And sort of as Phil was pointing out, there wasn't really a sense of empathy back. And in fact, there was a sense of anger, in many cases, violence on the part of the police department that really escalated these tensions. And that's something else the report found, that in many instances, the NYPD did play a part in escalating and making things worse. And that's kind of what we saw progressively over the span of a few weeks, where what started out as thousands of people taking to the streets pretty quickly devolved into these clashes between police officers and protesters.
Phil, the report found that part of the problem was that the NYPD, at least according to them, lacked a clearly defined strategy. Again, how do you go into a series of protests and not have a strategy? And if you could explain, in fact, Phil, what generally are the strategies that police officers and departments, I would imagine they're somewhat similar across the country, employ to manage protests? What are some of the best practices that this NYPD did not do?
Well, I think a starting point is you have to give people the opportunity to express their First Amendment rights. People need to be allowed to protest. And what we saw here was that the police simply don't handle situations well when they are the target of the protesters. It's an us versus them mentality. And they really come at this with a warrior mentality as opposed to a guardian mentality. So a better approach in terms of strategies in dealing with these types of protests would be to engage and to exhibit a guardian mentality, to make sure that there are things in place to protect people who are actually protesting and not to corral them and make them into the criminals, which is what we saw here time and again. One of the things that the NYPD pointed out was that they were caught off guard, that they weren't expecting this. But of all the police departments across the United States. The NYPD has the most resources, the most abilities to be able to respond and to change on a dime, to be able to handle situations as they arise. And they ought to be able to deal with this without really any difficulties at all. So here, one of the complications was that these were not protests that were organized in advance. These weren't the types of protests where there were groups there that, where their leaders went down and obtained permits and engaged in discussions with the city government in terms of how these protests would unfold, where they would take place. It was much more organic than that. And I think the problem that we have in law enforcement is they really aren't situated to handle that sort of spontaneous protest arising in a city where law enforcement hasn't planned ahead for it. And they need to rethink that.
There was a point in the summer, Phil and Jake, where we as, you know, citizens, as journalists, knew and expected there to be ongoing protests. It sort of became part of our daily conversation over the summer, in particular, following the death of George Floyd. So I'm just surprised that the NYPD just couldn't anticipate that. And Jake, the NYPD also has a community affairs bureau, and they were not involved in the department's response to the protests. Why were they not? And what is their role?
Yeah, I think the Community Affairs Bureau is sort of supposed to play that guardian role that Phil was mentioning. And the reason they weren't involved, according to one person interviewed in this report, is that the NYPD leadership just never called that, never came up. And so instead we saw that the NYPD was really relying on its strategic response group, which is this very controversial unit, deals a lot with terrorism. They're heavily armored. They have the sort of motocross gear where you can't see their faces. Very often you can't see their badge numbers because they don't have badge numbers.
Is that legal? I just want to go back a second, Jake.
Yeah,
it legal?
They are supposed to display their badge numbers. We inquired about this several times from the NYPD. They claimed that some of the people that I spoke to said that this was new equipment and they hadn't got a chance to put a badge number on it yet. And then when the NYPD was asked about this in the report, the department leadership said that they were not familiar with any instances in which a badge number was not visible. And I can tell you that probably about 50% of the time there's no badge number from what I saw in June and throughout the summer.
Phil, your thoughts on that? That the badge number feels like that is basic protocol.
You know, it's interesting. The Office of Independent Monitor in Denver, Colorado, issued a report in the last week or so where they brought up the same issue in Denver, where officers were not displaying their name tags and their badges during the protests. And it was a problem. This is not an isolated problem. And it's actually something that I remember as a young police officer more than three decades ago in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, there were yearly gatherings up on Lake Winnipesaukee, Bikers Weekend, and they brought in police officers from all across the state. And I remember being told as a young police officer that it was a common practice that officers would remove their name tags or sometimes wear a generic name tag that said something like Smith so that they could not be identified. This is a longstanding tactic that police departments use informally. It's probably not done at the chief level, but it's part of the police culture, part of the police subculture. It has been for a very long time when you have protest responses, mass disturbances, mass gatherings, where you're going to have a lot of interactions and potentially a lot of arrests, where officers in some places across the country routinely remove their badges, remove their name tags. So this is not something new. It's something that comes up periodically, but it's a long-standing part of the police subculture, and it's problematic. And as you pointed out, Tanzina, in some places there are actually state laws that require police officers to wear their names and their department affiliation on a patch on their outermost garment, and it's simply ignored in many places.
Jake, during the uprisings, particularly here in New York, there was a lot of egging on and a lot of rhetoric coming out of the police union here in New York City, coming out of certain politicians. I'm thinking particularly out on Staten Island, where really Nicole Malliotakis made this a critical issue as part of her campaign and won, you know, the support for the police. So did that have anything to do, Jake, you think, as far as how police officers responded to the protests, hearing, you know, these messages from other folks?
I think it would be fair to say that it probably had some effect. Yeah, I mean, the impact of the police unions in New York City and in a lot of places across the country is one that is, I think, in a lot of ways, pretty problematic. There have been many instances in which the leader of the Sergeants Benevolent Association in New York has shared things that are pretty racist. And he's come after protesters and he's painted them all as looters. We saw that on Long Island and Staten Island as well. And I think we saw that from the police commissioner. New York City Police Commissioner Dermot Shea has really sort of stood by his cops. He is a cop's cop. He's spread misinformation about protesters on a number of levels, and he suggested that they're stockpiling bricks ahead of protesters with no evidence. And I think that that does trickle down. I think that that's sort of part of the culture of the NYPD right now, is that there is this us first them mentality that Phil was talking about.
Phil, you mentioned that this issue of police officers covering up their badge numbers, which happened here in New York City with certain police officers, is also something that's happened in other cities across the country. Are there similar reports being done across the country about how police departments more broadly have responded to the uprisings for racial justice in this country over the summer? Because New York was not an isolated incident. These were protests that were happening in small cities, in large cities, in small towns. And I imagine many police departments were grappling with similar issues.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the Office of Independent Monitor in Denver, Colorado, issued a report that really tracked the New York report in many regards, dealing with systemic problems that were identified. We see in other jurisdictions, not so much in terms of reports. There are some others that are coming out that are being worked on, but largely it's just business as usual. And I think that's part of the problem. The problem that I have with the reports that we're seeing is that they, especially the New York report, specifically mentions that holding officers accountable who use excessive force, who assault people, that holding them accountable through charging them criminally, charging the officers with crimes, is something that doesn't make much sense to the writers of the report. They say it's difficult to prosecute police officers, makes work very hard for prosecutors because they rely on police officers in their daily work. They don't want to upset other officers. But I think that's really the core problem here, is that if we held officers accountable on an individual basis, ultimately, if enough officers are held accountable and charged with crimes when they commit crimes, and I'm not suggesting that all cops are criminals or that all cops are bad cops, but if the ones that are held accountable, I think we can make some systemic change over time.
How do you hold officers accountable, Jake?
I think it's a very tricky question. I mean, in New York City, we have seen that by and large, NYPD officers are not held accountable. And there are very few instances in which an officer faces any discipline for their action in this city. And for the most part, that I think is because of Mayor Bill de Blasio and Police Commissioner Dermot Shea. When this report came out, a lot of people said it fell short. It did not really find fault with the police leadership by name. It did not call for further investigation that would lead to accountability. And people who I spoke to said that until that happens, we're not going to see much of a change. And I think that, you know, when Mayor de Blasio says that he accepts these recommendations and he has to do better, that's in part because these recommendations don't really call for doing much beyond, you know, structural reforms that might take effect once he leaves office next year.
Well, we'll see what happens moving forward. Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and Jake Offenhartz is a reporter at Gothamist in New York City. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Thanks, Tanzina. It's good to be.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
With you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Last week, a film adaptation of August Wilson's 1982 play, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, premiered on Netflix. The movie stars Viola Davis as jazz singer Ma Rainey, and the late Chadwick Boseman as Levy, one of the members of Ma's band. Here they are in a scene from the film.
Levy, what were you doing? Why are you playing all them notes? You're playing 10 notes for everyone you're supposed to play. Don't call for all that. You're supposed to improvise on a theme. That's what I was doing.
You're supposed to play the song like I sing it, the way everybody else played.
Playing the song, I was playing the way I felt it.
I'm trying to sing my song and you messing up my ear. You call that playing music?
Yeah, I know what I'm doing.
Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is produced by actor Denzel Washington, who's planning to make movies from all 10 of Wilson's plays that compromise what's known as the century cycle. And through these films, many viewers, particularly younger ones, will be introduced to Wilson's work for the first time. And while his plays are sometimes taught in high schools, in at least one recent instance, that choice was met with controversy. The New York Times reported last week on a black student who was expelled from his private high school in North Carolina after his mother objected to plans to teach Wilson's play Fences in her son's ninth grade English class. The mother told the Times that she was worried that the play's themes were too mature for her son's majority white class. Joining me now to talk about Wilson's legacy is Mark Clayton Southers, founder and producing artistic director at the Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater Company. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Tanzina.
Also with us is Maya Phillips, critic at large for the New York Times. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Mark, you were mentored by August Wilson while he was still alive. What was your relationship like with him?
You know, August, I was a photographer when I met August the first time, and then I met him again as an actor. He was a giving person. He always took time to discuss things with you in detail. He wasn't hurried. He was a really down-to-earth person. I really enjoyed the time I spent with him.
And Mark, you are living and working in Pittsburgh, where August Wilson was born and many of his plays are set. What do his plays mean, particularly to Pittsburgh's black community?
Well, I mean, I think that the black community embraces August Wilson. It just comes across naturally. You know, the names of the people that are mentioned in the play, people can relate to, the streets that he mentions, some of the stories and situations, depending on which play. You know, most of the modern plays, the plays that he wrote that took place while he was alive, you know, not the plays that he wrote that took place back in the 30s and 20s, but the plays that took place, like Jitney, for instance, people knew a lot of those situations, like Two Trains Running, things like that, that he wrote about. Those were stories that people could relate to and people's names they could relate to, you know.
Maya, you've taken a deep dive into Wilson's work in a piece for the New York Times' Style magazine. What did you connect with in his writing?
I think for me, because I'm not just a critic, but I'm also a poet myself, I love the lyricism in his work, the attention to language, and also the fact that he has a combination of characters who have this grandiosity to them. There's this sense of royalty, but then are also very normal people. These are normal stories. They're living their daily lives, and that's also very familiar.
I was fortunate enough to see Fences on Broadway with Viola Davis and Denzel Washington here in New York, and then was able to catch the film adaptation of the play with the same characters and actors. And Maya, I'm curious how well you think August Wilson's work translates from the stage to the screen.
Well, I think so far the two adaptations we've seen have been great. I love the Fences was amazing, and I also love what George C. Wolfe has done with Ma Rainey. I think that his work, there's a very heavy emphasis on dialogue. He's all about the language. And there's not a whole bunch of actual, like, tradition, what you would traditionally think of as plot with, you know, things happening, characters, dramatic events. It's mostly people talking in rooms. And I think that so far what we've seen is filmmakers using the medium to emphasize the language, emphasize these characters in these spaces without losing that sense of how Wilson used his sense of the language and losing what Wilson did best. I think that so far that's been great.
Mark, why do you think Denzel Washington, as we mentioned, is slated to to produce a number of plays that August Wilson wrote. Why do you think now is a moment for this, for these plays to come out? Is there something special about this time and the relevance that Wilson's work can have in this moment?
Yeah, well, I think Denzel wants to make sure it gets done. I think Denzel's at a point in his career where, yes, he's still doing films. However, I think he wants to, I'm just surmising that he wants to have another legacy other than just being, you know, one of the greatest actors that we've had. I think he wants to cement August's legacy as well. He loves August's work. He embraces it. And I think that's one of the things he wants to do, along with Costanza Romero, August's widow. They set out to produce these. But I do want to note that there is a third film, the Hallmark film, The Piano Lesson, that was also done with was done several years ago. It was filmed here in Pittsburgh with Lloyd Richards directing. So there's actually three out there.
Maya, we mentioned that a mother in North Carolina objected to her son's English class reading Fences. She and her son are Black. The class is mainly made up of white students. What was that about? Tell us a little bit about her decision and how Wilson's work, you think, should be taught in majority white high schools.
Yeah, I think that personally, I would have loved to encounter August Wilson when I was in high school. That was not, he was not someone who was taught. And in general, we didn't have people of color taught. And I think that, you know, high schools do like to go to Harper Lee and Mark Twain and other writers who, you know, if it comes down to the language, they do use profane language. And I think most of all, it's an issue of the lack of diversity in those classrooms and the educators perhaps not knowing how to properly address it. But I don't think that it's an issue of whether August Wilson is appropriate for one person or another. I think that even though he's speaking specifically to the Black American experience, that there is universality in that. And we do need stories about Black Americans in which they are flawed, in which there might be some rough language. I think all students should be exposed to that personally.
Mark, you've directed performing arts high school students in some of Wilson's plays. Tell us a little bit about your approach, especially in light of what we were just talking about with Maya.
Yeah, we've done about five August Wilson plays so far at Pittsburgh Kappa High School. That's where Billy Porter attended the earlier version of the school. But it's always been great. The kids really embrace his work. They come in prepared. One of the things that we do is that we don't expect them to come off as these older characters. So I bring in our family of artists from the Pittsburgh area to come in and do monologues in front of them so they can watch the nuanced approaches, you know, because they're kids, you know, they haven't lived the life to have these type of experiences or to understand them fully. And it's worked out great for us. We've sold out every show basically. And the school, it's been welcomed by the community and the school. We haven't really had any issues. Like say for instance, with the N word, for instance, you know, people understand it, but you have to understand this is also a school that is a theater art school, and they come in prepared to do work like this.
Correct. And Maya, why do you think Wilson's work still resonates or resonates with a lot of young people today? Or is it something that's considered somewhat of a safe bet because he's of the Black playwrights, perhaps one of the better known?
I mean, I think it's both. I think especially in theater companies, he becomes the kind of token Black playwright. He's very safe. He's the go-to. And that's unfortunate because I think he himself wouldn't be into that idea. But I think that, yeah, it's certainly, his work certainly has resonance today. I mean, there's a Netflix documentary out, Giving Voice, about the August Wilson monologue competition and looking at some of these students responding to his work. And the themes that come up, the gentrification, about, you know, violence, about prejudice, code switching, all of those things are still so prevalent. And I think that students, when they get exposed to his work, they realize that, you know, this playwright is speaking to some part of my life, too.
And during his lifetime, August Wilson was also a major advocate, Maya, for Black-owned theaters and wanted Black directors to stage his work. Mm-hmm. How were those original stances viewed by the largely white theater establishment?
Well, he had a famously controversial statement about that and about like colorblind casting. And, you know, I think that a lot of times it's kind of viewed in a very narrow light that he was saying, you know, these things are only for Black people and they need to be segregated in a sense. And I don't take it as that. I was taking it as he was saying, there's also value in having spaces that are safe and accessible just for people of color to tell their stories. And so that we aren't just taking the same old like Shakespeare or Arthur Miller and trying to fit that into a vision of Black America, because those things weren't written for Black America.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Mark, I mean, speaking of, you know, August Wilson being one of the few Black playwrights whose work is consistently staged, particularly in places like Broadway, why do you think his work is breaking through to the extent that it did? It's not, these aren't easy topics, but something about Wilson's work is resonating and has resonated for decades.
Well, you have to understand that the door was cracked open with Lloyd Richards at the helm, with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom many moons ago and Fences. And, you know, Lloyd Richards at the time was very well known in the Broadway circles. And he, you know, August got in, his talent certainly carrying through the door, but the potential to make money on Broadway with these great stories, there's a lot of great African-American playwrights out here, and there's on the rise right now. You're going to see a lot more because of the George Floyd murder and things like this. You're going to see a lot of African-American getting their chance now, doors popping open now. But August got on the stage very early with Lloyd Richards. And once they parted ways and he continued to get on the stages, because the producers knew that it was a vehicle to make money as well. So there's a lot of change on the horizon about to come down the pike once this COVID thing gets out of the way.
And with that thought, I mean, Maya, are you optimistic and maybe even encouraged by what Mark is saying, that we will see more Black playwrights, Black American playwrights coming on to the stage and whose work will finally begin to get the recognition it deserves?
I mean, I certainly hope so. There's certainly been a movement, you know, during this pandemic that theaters have been called out for their coverage and how they lack diversity. And I'm hoping that we stick to that and that we see August Wilson, of course, but we also see other Black playwrights who should be surfaced.
Maya Phillips is critic at large for the New York Times, and Mark Clayton Southers is the founder and producing artistic director at the Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater Company. Thanks so much to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.